All right, welcome to another edition of The Special Relationship. I am Aaron, and I am in New York, and Freddie is in London, so the name Special Relationship actually makes sense this time.
It does indeed, and our connection has been pretty good. We managed to record a whole podcast.
Yeah, you might hear a couple technical difficulties in between, but not many at all. You might not even know that we're not in the same room. All right, Freddie, do you want to just break down for everyone what we talked about this podcast?
I can indeed. So on today's podcast, we talked a little bit about Aaron's column for The Junction on the Green New Deal, a little bit about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez herself and her rise to stardom. We also talked a little bit about the other alternatives to dealing with climate change, the idea of sort of these green billionaires coming out with their new policies. And then we brought it back to sort of Europe and said, how could this Green New Deal that the progressive movement in the United States is bringing about, how can that affect Europe in bringing about its own sort of climate reforms?
Okay, let's dive right in and begin with a conversation that we had about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Political courage. A New York for the many is possible. It's time for one of us. Vote for Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on June 26th.
Yeah, so it's really wild because it's only been, okay, so she, you know, as a congresswoman, I guess she was inaugurated on January 3rd. And there are like murals in my neighborhood of her. Yep. She's on like the cover of all these newspapers. Yep. After the State of the Union yesterday, the camera was like fixated on her. And she was like interviewed a couple times afterwards. And like for a member of this, you get more media attention if you're even a senator, you have name recognition. To be a freshman member of the House and for the entire country to know who you are is an incredible, incredible achievement, especially considering the policies that she represents.
Yeah, it's really crazy. Even when you watch like State of Union address, like the camera's like focusing on her occasionally, and it's like this is just like someone who's just come out of nowhere. I think it almost comes at quite a good time for the left in general in this country, because I feel like the Corbyn sort of surge that we saw, you know, last year or in 2017, sorry, it's sort of petering out a little bit with like a lot of frustration over his Brexit policy and his, you know, the Remainers wanted to come out in favor of a second referendum and the Leavers want him to come out with a sort of slightly harder line or at least like say something definite about how he's going to move forward once he gets into government. And so his personal popularity, I feel like, is sort of coming off a little bit of a cliff edge. I saw something from Robert Peston, who is a journalist on ITV News over here, and he was saying that inside source tells him at the Labour Party that membership of the Labour Party has dropped significantly over the last couple of months, which is really interesting because they obviously, when Corbyn first came in as the leader of the Labour Party, they went shooting up and they were like the biggest, you know, left party, political party in Europe in terms of membership. So he's sort of faltering, I think, maybe personally. And this sort of AOC rocket rise you've got in the States is almost a resurgence that people can go to sort of like a popular figure on the left that people can identify with. So I think that partly is coming at a good time for us over here.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because both Corbyn and Sanders are these older white guys who like had a ton of momentum behind them and galvanized all this excitement against the general population. I guess for Corbyn, the peak of that was probably after the general election, right, in like 2017, when he outperformed. And for Bernie Sanders, that was in 2016 during the presidential campaign. So you had all this energy and then it kind of dissipates a little bit. And then out of nowhere, now you have this like young, like democratic socialist that like the right-wing media doesn't know how to – they don't know what to do with her. They put all her policies down, and all her policies down like sound pretty good. And you can imagine that like the Foxer electorate is like – is looking at those on TV and is like, wait, like why are we vilifying her so much? Like those policies would actually like really help out with life. Yeah. You know, like these would – wait, it's like, wait a second. I actually really like these policies. So they don't know how to deal with her. And you even get the sense that it's kind of – it's bothering Trump as well. Because all of because what is he? He is the media kind of king. He sees himself.
He likes the attention.
Yeah, he loves the attention. To have this like young woman, this young Latino woman from the Bronx, getting all of this media attention must kind of just be like slowly eating him inside.
Yeah,
and I think you saw that in the tone that he took in the State of the Union. The way that he is conflating democratic socialism and Venezuela and trying to go on this like socialist fear-mongering agenda. I have a quote. He says that tonight we renew our resolve that America will never be a socialist country.
Yeah.
And that was a really interesting,
really big quote.
Really interesting, but it was really interesting for the optics. I don't know if you saw it during the State of the Union, because you had the Democratic establishment who's like Nancy Pelosi. So Mike Pence is cheering, and all the Republicans are really cheering. And then you have like half of the Democrats who are cheering, and Nancy Pelosi is like clapping her hands too. Then you see like Bernie Sanders just like staring there, like, ha ha, man, like you wait and see.
Yeah, you have
AOC there too. But it shows the divide. What that did is it shows the ideological divide within the Democratic Party, and how they embrace or distance themselves from this term socialism.
Yeah, well, I think I find it fascinating personally. You know, I'm not an expert on American politics, but if even the fact that Donald Trump had to say that is like mind-boggling, because you would think that no one would ever self-identify as being a socialist in the US a couple of years ago. So the fact that you have to come out and say like we're against like this like upsurge of socialism that's mm-hmm. happening in this country shows that it's like a real threat to him, right? Which is really interesting.
There was one tweet I saw on Twitter, and it's like Trump is basically, if he's playing this out as a binary and being like, okay, it's either me or socialism, he's like, that's such a massive win for the movement to be like, all right, it's either this status quo with this like inept guy who like, you know, can't really even like talk very well, doesn't really make any sense, or like socialism and then the policies that they represent. He's like, that's really a massive shift in the discourse and in the ideology within the United States, for sure.
Okay, so I thought we should start our conversation on the Green New Deal, on your topic. And I thought a good way of doing that is to ask you a question about, you know, in your column, you began by introducing your analysis of the Green New Deal and the progressive movement in the United States at the moment by talking about Naomi Klein's book, This Changes Everything, and how that helps us sort of understand the intimate connection between the climate crisis and capitalism. So I thought it'd be interesting for you to firstly tell me how why you think this is an appropriate fit for analyzing this problem.
Yeah, so I think her work provides a particularly appropriate piece to go back to within the current language that we're using right now that to describe the Green New Deal. A lot of people have criticized the Green New Deal for being too comprehensive, and that it not only addresses climate change, but yet you're also bringing in these issues of like wealth inequality and like structural inequalities that like are not related to the climate crisis in any way, and you're kind of you're trying to push this whole like socialist agenda under this like banner of climate change, and like that is just too much. It doesn't make any sense. So if you go back to the work that Naomi Klein has done, she demonstrates that all of these issues are intimately connected to each other. And she demonstrates this through an analysis of an ideology that she refers to as extractivism. So in my article, I kind of expand on this, but the basic tenets of this ideology is essentially that it's a non-reciprocal dominance-based relationship with the earth, one of truly taking. That's from Naomi Klein's text. And she states that it has its origins in this post-Enlightenment culture in which the central aim is to dominate the natural world and fellow human beings at the expense to maintain a constant drive for profit and prosperity. And what it does is it views both the natural world and fellow human beings, especially those who are on the periphery, as disposable. And she sees this as central to the neoliberal project as well, which she likewise defines as the privatization of the public sphere, the deregulation of the corporate sector, and the lowering of income and corporate tax rates. So basically, in order to tackle climate change, we need to address this ideology at the forefront of it.
Storm like Hurricane Maria would have sent any society reeling. But what really turns these storms into a catastrophe is the intersection of austerity, white supremacy, the fact that not every life is treated of equal value, right? So if you are in a majority, black and brown, a part of the world, you are not going to receive the same response as if you were in a wealthier white area. And we saw this in the response for Hurricane Katrina. But the other thing that Puerto Rico really underlines is how vulnerable the logic of austerity, the reality of austerity, makes a society. Right? And Puerto Rico gives us a very acute illustration of this.
Okay, so taking Naomi Klein's theory about comprehensiveness and how this has to be sort of a bottom-up movement if we're going to effectively deal with the problem of climate change, tell me how you think that this new progressive movement, the Green New Deal, the actual documents came out a couple of days ago. Tell me how you think that this is specifically addressing climate change in the way in which Naomi Klein talks about in her book.
Yeah, so Naomi Klein has a quote where she says that fighting inequality on every front and through multiple means must be understood as a central strategy in the battle against climate change. And what the Green New Deal resolution does, really interesting, that was recently introduced by AOC and Senator Markey, is that it uses the language that Naomi Klein refers to in addressing other structural inequalities that are both a direct result of climate change and that are going to threaten those who are on the front lines of this crisis. There's a quote from the resolution that was released, and it says, "Whereas climate change, pollution, and environmental destruction have exacerbated systemic, racial, regional, social, environmental, and economic injustices that by disproportionately affecting indigenous peoples, communities of color, migrant communities, deindustrialized communities, depopulated rural communities, the poor, low-income workers, women, the elderly, the unhoused, people with disabilities, the youth." And that language to me is really interesting because they're viewing climate change not just as some static issue, but something as deeply ingrained within the foundations and the structures of our society. So I think her text is really a useful tool in analyzing why the Green New Deal kind of is laid out in the way that it is and why it is so comprehensive.
So she talks about this language of extractivism and needing to deal with capitalism if you're going to be able to deal with these crises. And this language is sort of mirrored by the progressive agenda in this new document. Would you say that in doing so, I mean, I haven't read this book by Naomi Klein, so I don't know the theory as well as you do. So would you say that this idea that she's putting forward is that climate change can only be sufficiently tackled by a socialist regime? Because that seems quite an extreme idea to be putting forward and not particularly one that would be very favorable in the States, you know, for a lot of people.
Yeah, she doesn't use the word socialism. Or
it's more anti-capitalist.
The word socialism, yeah, exactly. It's just like explicitly anti-capitalist and explicitly anti this form of capitalism that we're seeing now. Nowhere in here does it say that we need to take the means of production or anything like that. But it's saying that we need to systematically address these issues, and we need to do it from a perspective that is going to be a radical dismissal of this dominant economic ideology. It's beyond even capitalism too. The thing that why I find the extractivism concept quite interesting is because it goes back to kind of these like Enlightenment myths, and even you could even say these biblical myths of man being superior to nature and the natural world around him. So it's almost she takes it. Yes, she is explicitly critiquing neoliberalism, but she's also critiquing just our relationship with the natural world in a way that almost becomes like a spiritual regeneration in that sense too, which is quite exciting, I find.
Okay, so seeing it through that lens, we'll go on a little bit in a minute to look at the different people running for presidential office in 2020. But you talk in your column about the idea of green billionaireism. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that term? Is that something that you came up with? And also how that is, you know, the antithesis of what Naomi Klein is talking about?
Yeah, so I guess I don't know if I came up with the term, but I thought it was really fun. I searched it up. I didn't really find it many other places. Green billionaireism is kind of fun too, because if you just look at like airism, it just kind of signifies something that's like empty. So I tried to show something that was kind of like an empty term in that regard. But green billionaireism is a way to kind of view how people think that like the market can handle climate change, either through like this Elon Musk demonstration of how we're going to create these new technologies that are going to radically transform our energy grids and the ways that we consume and use this energy. And it relates to the language that kind of Bloomberg and other billionaires, I think Schultz as well, are referring to climate change and saying that we can let the market handle this, and it has a way of kind of addressing these core problems. And what is so interesting about Naomi Klein's work is that she goes on this whole rampage where she attacks these billionaires who are going to tackle this crisis, especially Richard Branson. She really goes after and is saying that he was in the beginning, maybe like a decade ago, he was on the forefront of this like climate crisis fight. And he was saying a lot of really good things, saying that even all of the money that he was going to earn or above a certain point, he was going to donate back into finding ways to kind of to address climate change and so on. But he is so invested in the dominant economic system and profits directly from it, so that while he's saying all these things, he's still building and still expanding his airline company, which is emitting massive amounts of CO2, and that basically this desire for these short-term profits are too much to kind of relinquish at the expense of the climate. So it's an interesting way to view this, and I think that one that needs to be addressed, because I think we're going to see as climate change comes more to the forefront, we're going to see people kind of embrace this Green New Deal. But they're not going to embrace it in the way that AOC and Naomi Klein and some of these other people in the more of a progressive agenda, they're going to embrace it from like kind of free market solutions. And I don't think that's the way that we can adequately deal with this crisis.
I guess a lot of people would critique AOC for perhaps using the climate crisis and this Green New Deal as a way of promoting her own cause of socialism. But I guess from your point of view, you would argue that it is explicitly almost necessary to find a new way of thinking about our economic system if we're going to deal with the climate crisis itself anyway.
Yeah, and what the UN assessment and the fact that it came at this time is demonstrating is that we can't just sit here and be passive and wait for some kind of green billionaires or some innovators to come up with some solution that's going to drastically reduce our carbon emissions and prepare our entire infrastructure in order to deal with the ramifications of climate change while also doing it in a non-carbon way. So we need some massive, massive kind of state project to lead the way. And I think that is kind of like the logical response to what the UN has called for.
You know, Trump ran his candidacy based off this myth that like just because he's not even a billionaire, I don't think, but if you're really wealthy, then you have succeeded at the American dream, and that makes you fit to run for the president of the United States. And there's a lot of other billionaires who are kind of going to feed off of that similar assumption, that just because you're rich, you're just like really smart, really gifted, and you're such a great leader, and you can obviously, you know, take care of 300 million people with all of their best interest at heart.
Not naming any names here.
Yeah, so the first billionaire to publicly announce really was Howard Schultz, who's running as an independent, which is really just infuriating a large portion of this population.
Why is he running as an independent?
Because he thinks that the Democratic Party has gone too left. So this is really the AOC effect. It's really astonishing. I wonder if AOC wasn't running, he might have still run as an independent, but much less likely. If this were 8 years ago, he'd probably be running as a Democrat. But you can see his strategists are being like, okay, the Democrats are probably going to elect someone with kind of like a socialist agenda, like in that Bernie Sanders, Warren kind of camp. That's looking most likely, or people who are going to embrace those policies, like Kamala Harris and all these other people who are embracing Medicare for All and Green New Deal. So he's like, okay, that's who the Democrats are probably going to elect, and then the Republicans are going to have Trump again. So there's this middle ground where, you know, you have like the fiscally conservative guy, you know, like socially liberal, as they used to call them. And like Schultz just going to like feed off of that. He is like the clearest chance of the presidency that any independent has ever had. So he's probably banking on that. And he's saying, right. I'm not a Democrat because we can't afford the policies of what the Democratic Party is now embracing.
OK, so before we move on to talking about a sort of state funded project and what that might look like, the other billionaire who's said he's going to run for president in 2020 is Bloomberg. Now, I know this is someone you touched on in your column. Can you give us a little bit of a sort of background on him as a person?
He is the former mayor of New York City. So He already has a lot of like name recognition in the United States for doing that, and of course being the CEO of the Bloomberg media company, media empire. And he's been an advocate for tackling climate change for quite a while now. But a lot of these initiatives are kind of just like short-term kind of investments or eating more organic food and just kind of these short steps, but not addressing any kind of the structural change that Naomi Klein alludes to in her book. So it's an entirely, his approach is very much kind of top down. And what I included in my article is this clip of Bloomberg responding to a question in New England of a girl who asked him how his personal life and his personal routine demonstrates kind of his legitimacy in effectively dealing with the climate crisis. So we can just play that clip quickly.
Hi, I'm Carly. I am a political science major of New England College. I am personally a big environmental person, and I was wondering, you are very big on changing the big aspects, but personally, are you a vegan? Do you, like, in your own personal life, do you take big, veganism, like a reduced life or waste lifestyle, and like, do you drive an environmentally friendly car and whatnot?
Well, let me first start by saying I'm addicted to Cheez-Its and popcorn. And if you can get rid of all the other bad things, but just don't get rid of those two, I'd be very happy. I also am addicted to Subway sandwiches and could eat one every night for dinner. Now, that'll help the Subway company. I don't have any stock in it. I have no axe to grind here, folks. I just like Subway sandwiches. I've watched my diet as I've gotten older. I eat a lot less red meat. Love to have a hamburger at Mellon's every once in a while. Haven't had a steak very seldom, but if served, I would eat it. And I'm not an absolutist about that. I eat more fish than before, and with mercury, that you should certainly worry about that. I do a lot of meals. I'll just have a fruit salad or iceberg lettuce or something. But as you get older, you become more conscious, I think, of some of the stuff. And with my work at Johns Hopkins and the School of Public Health, I am much more sensitive than I used to be. Do I do everything? I exercise every day, half an hour on alternate days and an hour between. Does that mean I'm going to live longer? I don't know, but you just should do some common sense things. I haven't had a cigarette in 40 years. I am on a new campaign to go a year without a drink. I'm 2 months into it. Thank you very much. I did that 2 years ago for a year, with the exception of having a lot of white wine on my 75th birthday.
What really got me riled up and kind of got me interested in writing this article about Bloomberg is when he goes out and he says that, like, we can't afford these policies. Like, we can't afford Medicare for all. Or when Schultz has a similar argument when he says that we can't afford this. And when the person who's stating that we can't afford something is the 10th richest person on this planet, and when the top 26 richest people own as much wealth as nearly half the entire world population, I think they lose all legitimacy and credibility in discussing what we can afford and what cannot afford. Yeah, I mean, and it comes back into this kind of the dream, this American dream, and how we view success in completely monetary terms. So Schultz recently came out, and I have a link in the article, where he says that, like, he doesn't understand why people don't like him. And he's like, because he's so out of touch with, like, the general population. And he probably could have been a lot more successful in the Democratic ticket maybe 8-12 years ago.
Yeah.
And he's saying, like, I'm rich. I'm supposed to be like the guy that you guys all look up to. Like, I'm the guy. Like, how do you not like me? This doesn't make any sense. You know, I've succeeded at the American dream. I can be president. And people are like, no, like, it's immoral for you to have that much wealth while people are starving every day, living on poverty wages, wage stagnation. So.
Yeah, you get that in this country too. Recently, there was an interview I saw with Owen Jones and Tim Martin, who's the owner of Wetherspoons.
Yeah,
if anyone who doesn't know, in America, is the Wetherspoons is the go-to pub, chain pub for all
chain pub
of the British youth.
Yes.
But Owen Jones, left-wing political journalist in this country, socialist, was interviewing Tim Martin, and he said, do you think it's immoral for you to be so wealthy as you are and also be paying so many of your employees poverty wages? And Tim Martin just goes, oh, ridiculous question, stupid question, move on.
The truth is, you are yourself part of the elite. You're a very wealthy man. And many of your workers are on poverty wages. And the taxpayer has to spend huge amounts of money in work benefits.
It's just a silly conversation.
Well, it's not a silly conversation.
Poverty wages.
They're being paid £8.5 an hour, and you can't live on £8.5 an hour. Surely you could give them a living wage.
Have you checked that on £8.5
an hour? How much are your bars
paid? The point is...
How much are they paid?
Owen, are you constantly interrupting me? I mean,
I'm asking for an answer.
It's a childish interview. You've been on the Stella. This is what's causing him to interrupt.
It's like he's not even computing. He's just like, I'm winning and they're losing, and they're losing because they're not as good at the game as I am. Which is like, it's just this method of thinking that it's just running into brick walls over and over again.
And a complete like abandonment of any kind of notion of privilege as well, which is really like central to the discourse in the United States, especially.
Okay, so that was the first half of the podcast, talking a little bit about Aaron's column. We now move into the second half of the podcast, where we start to get a little bit more theoretical and talk about why capitalism inherently can't deal with this problem of extractivism and specifically the climate crisis.
Through the long 20th century, capitalism has always managed to find a way through many different crises. I mean, people call it a very efficient economic system that lots of people would argue differently. David Graeber is one that comes to mind. But people argue that capitalism and the free markets are very efficient at dealing with the problems that they have in front of them. And once capitalism, as maybe it will do now, since, as you say, we've had the UN reports give you so little time to deal with these climate issues, once it recognises the problems that it has in front of it, the free market will be able to act efficiently in the interest of its own long-term profit in dealing with the climate crisis. And people like Elon Musk, you know, many people that might be listening to the podcast might be saying, well, Elon Musk going out and inventing all of these amazing new technologies, I mean, he's probably the guy that should be in charge of these sort of things because he's done ridiculously impressive, you know, feats when it comes to entrepreneurship and technology in the past. How do you respond to people making those arguments?
Yeah, so I think it is great that Elon Musk is innovating and that some of these billionaires are innovating and providing the technological means to deal with the climate crisis and kind of re-envisioning our energy grids and so on. I think that's fantastic. But there's nothing inherent within some of these socialist policies that would prevent innovation. In fact, there's a strong argument to be made that some of these policies will actually exaggerate the ability to innovate, such as subsidies and just generally investing in our education, which would be a fantastic resource in order to creatively deal with some of these crises that are going to result from climate change. And I think this kind of just goes back into the debate that we kind of saw at Davos, in the sense that we don't want just billionaires' philanthropy. What we need are higher taxation rates, because what climate change demonstrates is that these are collective problems and we need collective solutions. And under that guideline, the state is best equipped to adequately handle this crisis.
I think a good argument here is that, you know, a lot of people would say, well, it obviously is in their interest, as it is in anyone's interest, to make sure the planet stays alive, you know, for their grandchildren as much as it is for anyone else's. I guess a solid reason why I take to the work of Naomi Klein and this sort of theoretical framework that you're providing in your column is that if you leave it up to these billionaires to, you know, through philanthropy schemes and through technologies that their firms create to deal with this climate crisis, what you effectively end up doing is create a sort of debt where these people have, you know, provided, if they succeed in, firstly, they may not succeed in doing it. And secondly, you just almost tie the bulk of the population that isn't able to contribute in the way that they might want to fighting this crisis. They sort of put them into a debt to these billionaires who are out there at the front saying that we're the ones doing this, you guys all owe us, which almost seems to me to be a little bit of a counter to what you should be actually aiming for, which is sort of a communal recognition of a problem.
And the idea of collective wealth and collective issues. Mm-hmm. And if you have this discourse of individualism and it's, you know, up to everyone to get to their own end goal in life, how are you ever going to deal with collective problems that transcend those individual abilities?
Yeah, and a communal, I think it's really difficult to envision these companies just investing in the necessary means that we need to tackle this. I mean, like, we need to completely transform our infrastructure and energy grids. And it's hard to see these people kind of donating that kind of investment in these projects straight off the bat. But I mean, it is in there. I mean, Elon Musk would love it. You know, he can generate a ton of profit, and there is a lot of profit to be had in this process. It's just a matter of how it's going to be distributed.
You know, when we talk about this conversation on marginal tax rates, it's an economic question, but it's also a moral question. Mm. It is the policy translation of a proposed answer to what kind of society do we want to live in. Mm-hmm. Are we comfortable with a society where someone can have a personal helipad mm-hmm. while this city is experiencing the highest rates of people experiencing homelessness and, mm-hmm. since the Great Depression? Mm-hmm. Should those two things coexist mm-hmm. at the same time? Mm-hmm. It's saying, where do we draw the line mm-hmm. in excess? Mm-hmm. And at what point do we return to this question that King asked, that Gandhi asked, that is our material technology outpacing our moral technology? Mm-hmm. Is our material sophistication outpacing our human sophistication?
So one of the parts of this Green New Deal resolution is focusing on international exchange. And one of the sections, I'll just read it quickly. It says that promoting the international exchange of technology, expertise, products, funding, and services with the aim of making the United States the international leader on climate action and to help other countries achieve a Green New Deal. And recently in Europe, we've been seeing a mobilization calling for the policies of a Green New Deal. You're seeing this with children's strikes throughout Europe, and you're seeing this with a group that's called Extinction Rebellion, which is nonviolently utilizing civil disobedience tactics in order to gain attention on adequately handling this climate crisis. And you're seeing it in some policies from more progressive parties throughout Europe. So I guess initially, just how would you say that this call for a Green New Deal and this movement and this energy is kind of being used to catalyze this movement in Europe or in the UK?
Yeah, so first things first would be to point out, as you say, that the Green New Deal, AOC, the popularity which she's getting, the popularity which the whole movement is gaining in the States is massive for the rest of the world. Because obviously, you know, this is a transnational problem, but America is the leading light. You know, it's what Western countries sort of aspire to. Everyone's looking up for them to take the lead, the lead industrial nation. And so when Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord, that was very symbolic. And you saw climate activists across the world coming out, you know, in uproar at the fact that Donald Trump had done that. And with him in the White House giving his State of the Union speech, not mentioning climate change at all, you know, it's a very, you know, it's a worrying precedent to set for everyone else in the world. So having AOC there at the forefront of the American sort of media at the moment with this Green New Deal is amazing for people in Europe, particularly on the left, because you can identify with her. You can say, look, this is what America is doing. We've got to follow this lead. This is the mainstream now. She's shifting the discourse. This is what we need to focus on. To talk about European politics when it comes to green politics, it's difficult because across the world, you see, particularly in Europe, you see democratic parties split in governments between explicitly green parties that pedestal climate change and dealing with those problems as the central tenet of their manifestos. And then you have the the left wing, you know, sometimes the socialist, sometimes sort of the conservative left parties, who are more concerned about, you know, getting into office and then, you know, enacting their economic policies. And climate change, although often a big topic, tends to be sidelined slightly, but because it's dominated by this other left Green Party. Now, if you look at the UK at the moment, we have a Green Party that isn't gaining particularly, because Jeremy Corbyn has managed to bring a lot of climate activists under the umbrella of his sort of socialist campaign. And he's done that quite successfully. And I'm sure AOC and her movement has helped him in doing that. So as you know, to answer your question specifically, we do see people, particularly in this country, obviously, that's what I can speak best about, on the socialist left with Jeremy Corbyn, talking about climate change in the context of a wider ideological battle against these policies of extractivism under a neoliberal banner, which you talked about before.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting perspective to take it from this institutional lens, in a sense. So because there's a two-party system in the United States, it means that you can't just treat climate change and run on climate change as some separate party and expect to be electorally successful. In Europe, it's interesting because you do have a history of green parties who run and they form coalitions with other parties, and their main focus is just on the climate. But if you look at it from the perspective of kind of what Naomi Klein is referring to and how AOC and the Green New Deal is approached, it demonstrates that it is intimately tied to our economic system. So from viewing this, it's an interesting take if traditionally left parties, social democratic parties, are aligning themselves with Green New Deal and bold action for climate change, because it'll signify this more comprehensive approach that perhaps is lacking when you just have one party that's running on this as like their sole platform.
Yeah, and I think what left-wing parties can do, if they choose to, is to talk about this idea of democratizing climate change. As you said before, you know, climate change and the impacts climate change is going to have is, you know, isn't equal. It's not going to affect everyone equally. And it's a communal problem. So if you can give everyone a communal say in how we're going to tackle it, I think that is something that will play well with the voters who like to have, you know, the feeling that they have agency over their own individual problems. And that's a very much something that aligns with a sort of socialist agenda.
Yeah. So I'd say one thing to kind of look forward to is the fact that, so climate change is a transnational issue, is going to require some kind of transnational solution. It's not just one state can't lead the way in this. You need a lot of actors involved and some kind of enforcement mechanisms, it would seem, as well. One thing that we noticed when we went to the World Transformed event was that in order to have kind of a successful Corbyn agenda, you're going to need actors in other countries kind of supporting it, or else it just simply doesn't seem like it's going to work. And one thing that's kind of inspiring with the climate change movement is the fact of how these different left organizations and political mobilizations are coming together. That was seen recently at the Sanders Institute event, where you had Varoufakis and this DM movement kind of publicly announcing their support for this Bernie Sanders progressive movement in the United States. So I guess, how would you see the importance of transnational and parties kind of forming and collectively joining together to demonstrate their support for these climate initiatives?
Well, as you say, the World Transformed was fantastic to see that sort of transnational solidarity. We had Mélenchon, the leader of the left party in France, coming over and talking a lot about man's relationship with the natural world and how he was looking to redefine that in his campaign. And you also had Katja Kipping from the German party Die Linke, the left party, talking about how human beings need to redefine their relationship with work and how we can use things like the four-day week, which I know she is supporting research on at the moment, how we can use things like that and to help deal with the climate crisis. So you have voices coming out in favor of that all across Europe. And it's very interesting, as you say, to talk about this transnational movement, DM, Democracy in Europe movement, which Varoufakis is heading up, and he's looking to run a whole load of MEPs in the elections in May. And one, obviously, the main platform that they're running on is that they want to make the European Union more transparent. They want to democratize it, give people a true say in how the European Union works, so that it isn't just this stone wall of bureaucrats that doesn't allow for decision making. And one of the main things that they put forward for why they think that this is an important idea, you know, obviously beyond just the democracy itself, is just to deal with climate change. It's important to have this sort of communal decision-making process so that people can coordinate and understand what they're moving towards and how they're going to deal with the economic problems that climate change you need to deal with, overcome this issue of climate change. So I think, just to bring this back almost more theoretically, the left and the socialist left and those who stick to a sort of Marxist ideology is innately transnational. Marxism is sort of an innately transnational term and international. And they want to form these international movements. And it fits in very well with this need to deal with climate change, which is a transnational, international problem. So those two things are a very strong, cohesive bond between political movements across countries.
Yeah, I guess one of the scary parts of this is this rise of nationalism, isolationism, even Brexit as well, and kind of this desire to go back into the nation state. And I guess with this whole Brexit debate and with the debate of the European Union, while the European Union has been quite good on tackling issues of climate change and consumer regulations, what the Brexit debacle, in a sense, is doing is it's taking the attention away from climate change right now. And I guess, how would you see Brexit within the perspective of our ability to handle the crisis, especially considering that what we need is some kind of transnational kind of system, and the European Union, while it has a lot of flaws, does provide that infrastructure in kind of dealing with these issues?
Well, look, Brexit is something that, gets a lot of coverage, obviously, in the news, and everyone has their own opinion as to what caused Brexit. And, you know, people argue a lot about the economics and, you know, the disenfranchisement of working class people who feel like they're being misled or mistreated by the state. I think one thing that we can, or people can unify on, particularly on the left, is that it is an opportunity now, and as Donald Trump has been in the United States, for people on the left to demonstrate how they are not, they're not aligned with this right-wing populist ideology, and how they can demonstrate and show to people that they have a cohesive alternative to turn to. So AOC has positioned, and Bernie Sanders as well, if he's going to run for president, you know, can position himself as the alternative, international alternative, to those who are not willing to retreat into the nation state and are willing to look out internationally to deal with these problems, climate change being a very, very prominent one amongst those. And I think you see Brexit in the same light as you see Trump on that front, as an opportunity for the left party. I mean, in this country, it's very difficult because although the Brexit vote was 52-48, in reality, it was over 400 constituencies that voted leave. So it's very politically difficult for a left party to come out against Brexit. And I understand that in what Jeremy Corbyn's trying to do at the moment with his sort of customs union soft Brexit idea. But you can use the populist rhetoric and the right-wing rhetoric to position yourself as, look, we are internationalist, we are outward facing, and we are going to work transnationally, internationally, to deal with these problems such as climate change. So I would see it as an opportunity, and I'm sure people in the States are seeing Donald Trump as the same.
Great. So we just talked a little bit about kind of political parties coming together and leaders symbolically coming together, which is really significant. But I guess a source of optimism I have, and what really kind of motivates me and inspires me for the future of what this movement entails, is seeing the youth participating in this and seeing certain mobilizations that are almost independent of parties. So you have the Sunrise Movement in the United States, which was really kind of the driving force for this Green New Deal, and which AOC did actively come out in support of. But what you're seeing in Europe as well are these massive children movements and people have boycotting school or saying or having these, I'm seeing images from all across Europe of children coming together in the streets and demanding that we take real comprehensive action against climate change. And with these movements like Extinction Rebellion, which are popping up with chapters all around the world. So one thing that gets me really excited are these kind of independent mobilizations that are forming chapters all around the world that can really be a trigger in pressuring our political leaders to take real bold action on this front.
So I reckon that just about wraps it up for this week's episode of the Special Relationship Podcast. Aaron, just before we head off, yes or no answer, do you think in the next couple of years we will see a successful Green New Deal pass in the United States?
I don't think you're going to see this in the next year or two, but I think, you know, within the next short term, maybe 5 years or so, if Democrats get the House, maybe the Senate, get the presidency, who knows it. But there's definitely is a lot of momentum on the side. And I think pushed by social movements and kind of a bottom up approach, I think we're going to see. Yeah, I think we're going to see something pass.
OK, well, you heard it here first. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. If you want to hear more of the Special Relationship Podcast, you can find it on The Junction at thejunction.space. You can also check it out on the Twitter at TweetTheJunk.
That's junk with a C. Junk with a C.
All right. Thanks for tuning in.
Have a hamburger at Mellon's every once in a while. Haven't had a steak very seldom, but if served, I would eat it. And I'm not an absolutist about that. I eat more fish than before. And with mercury, that you should certainly worry about that. I do a lot of meals. I'll just have a fruit salad or iceberg lettuce or something. But as you get older, you become more conscious, I think, of some of the stuff. And with my work at Johns Hopkins and the School of Public Health, I am much more sensitive than I used to be. Do I do everything? I exercise every day, half an hour on alternate days and an hour between. Does that mean I'm going to live longer? I don't know, but you just should do some common sense things. I haven't had a cigarette in 40 years. I am on a new campaign to go a year without a drink. I'm 2 months into it. Thank you very much. I did that 2 years ago for a year, with the exception of having a lot of white wine on my 75th birthday. And then last year...